close. Yeah.
Thank you.
See if that clock
Hold on, is. Okay, yeah.
It's, there's nothing.
Not yours anyway.
There's nothing. Sure. So some point in our class is like 30. It's California.
I call the House Committee on Health.
Let me
care to order.
Okay.
Leave it here so we're better.
And open up a. Oh, do we have any bills for work session?
No, Mr. Chair, not right now.
Thank you.
Is the two vice chairs.
Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2503. And open up a public hearing on House Bill 2504. Madam Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, we have House Bill 2503 and 2504 in front of us at the request of Representative Nathanson. 2503 directs the Health Licensing Office to issue lactation consultant and a lactation educator licenses to qualified applicants. This would be housed in the Office of Health Licensing, and 2504 just adds peer support provider to the applicant requirement as well for the Health Licensing Office.
It's the same as 2303, except it has...
It adds peer support.
Peer support.
Correct.
Okay.
Rep. Nathanson?
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Hello. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. Thank you for hearing these bills. House Bill 2503, the first one, is the one I think you'll receive the most testimony or focus on. These bills, but I'll just say from now on this bill, because it's really one basic concept, this bill is another great example of when constituents come to us with an idea, there's a problem or a concern, and then they help figure out a solution. They roll up their sleeves and they get to work. In this case, you'll notice that it's Daisy Chain that had requested my help with this idea. CHAIN stands for Creating Healthy Alliances in New Mothering. This bill would put Oregon ahead of most other states in helping new mothers with breastfeeding support services. Anything new is going to be hard, that's for sure, but we believe it's worth doing it, and it's time. You will hear from the advocates why the bill is needed. And you'll hear from some others about specific concerns. Some of them are technical, some are a little bit more about policy. But maybe not so much that Oregon shouldn't do this, but how should it be done, and are there any unintended consequences of the way the bill is drafted? I want to assure you that with the help of interested parties, we are already working on several aspects of the bill as the language was originally drafted. For example, whether already licensed healthcare professionals are already certified. And furthermore, the main objective of this bill is to expand access to quality services. Individuals may have received bona fide training and certification from more than a single national organization. Any who have received certification should meet the conditions for licensing in Oregon. Examples are the International Board of Lactation Consultant Examiners and the Academy of Lactation Policy and Practice. It should also recognize that USDA required education being provided by the staff of WIC, the Women, Infants, and Children program provided through the Oregon Health Authority. That should also be recognized. Another technical point that we're working on is to align the language to the extent that it's possible and appropriate. We want to align it with that being used or thought about in other states, such as Rhode Island or Georgia. Licensing isn't free, but it doesn't have to be so costly that it's a barrier to the people who want to provide the service. In fact, it was the lactation service providers themselves who approached me and said that they were willing to consider licensing and have to pay a license fee. You will hear from them today. To put this in perspective, a fee for this license might be in the range of $150 to $200. I don't have a specific number in the bill. But how does that compare to other licenses? A license for a CNA, a certified nurse assistant, is $106. A nail technician or hairstylist is 115. A tattoo artist is 250, and midwives $600. So that's how that might compare, for example. There is certainly more that could be done. You may hear in testimony from some other kind, from some people about other kinds of problems in providing lactation services, such as limited panels of providers as defined by an insurer, or a confusion or lack of standardization or lack of specificity in the codes that are used for medical billing. In this bill, we're dealing only with licensing. We are not attempting to tackle those other issues, such as billing codes or provider panels. This step, licensing, will make a significant difference. To the extent that there are some other barriers to work on in the medical system, such as in-network or out-of-network coverage or billing codes, we certainly hope that others will take them on. But it doesn't have to be included in this bill for this bill to be of value. We are working with Legislative Council and the Health Licensing Office to answer questions and mitigate problems, and we would anticipate presenting one or more amendments to you and would provide them to you as they become available. I hope that if you have any questions specific about the bill and how it works, that you will ask the people who've been most involved in developing the proposal, the advocates or others who will testify here today. And Mr. Chair, it's my hope that you will provide guidance to those stakeholders who are here today and let them know what sorts of amendments might be useful.
You mean be nice to them.
I value the guidance that you will provide. So thank you for hearing the bill. I think it will help Oregon move forward. As written to me in an email message to my office, quote, "We know when mamas receive reliable lactation support, babies thrive, and the citizens of our state enjoy good health and well-being." That's why we're doing it. Thank you.
Any questions, Representative Nathanson?
Yeah,
sure. Yes, Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm very supportive of the concept. I'm just a little confused about what problem we're trying to solve with this.
The problem, and the advocates, Mr. Chair and Representative Bueller, the advocates, I believe, will give you some very specific examples. The problem when they first came to me was that there are providers who want to provide the service. They try to raise funds. They try to provide service to as many mothers as they can. But there were a number of circumstances that lead the provider to being unable to bill for the service. Many providers were able to bill, but some were not. And it has to do with a sort of an uneven application of what was thought to be a national direction that the service be reimbursed, but different practices by different insurers, or whether it was a hospital or outside a hospital situation, for example, some were able to bill for the service and some were not.
Got it. So follow up. So the ACA mandated coverage of this service, but then it was uncertain actually who could provide the service and be recognized for billing purposes?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, that's correct. Okay. And I hope that you will ask the question, if it's not answered a little bit more fully by the advocates who are here today, I hope you will ask it again.
Sure. I have a question. Do you have an idea of what the number of potential licensees are? I'm worried about the fee question because, you know, there are 40,000 CNAs to spread the risk, and there are 100 direct entry midwives. Mm-hmm. And I think I remember that license was 1,500, not 600.
No.
What happened?
It went down.
Good.
It did go down with a lot of work. Yep.
A lot of work and not so much litigation.
Mr. Chair, it's a few hundred. We think it's about 400.
Well, a few hundred makes it a manageable.
Yeah.
Great.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
Just a quick note. Thank you, Mr. Chair, to thank you for your work. I'm eager to hear the advocates, and I'm eager to hear the various ways in which perhaps they want to change it. But it's a very important area. And I also think that we need to be thinking about how do we support this area if the ACA mandate to cover breastfeeding actually goes away. So I just want to just say again how important breastfeeding is in the life cycle of children and moms. So just appreciate you bringing this to us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to start with a couple of panels of the advocates and then ask the Health Licensing Office to come and talk to us about what's on their mind about this. Will you call the first panel, and I'll make a comment.
Jacqueline Mahoney, Jenny Hawthorne Mays, and Sarah Longwell.
I'm going to ask you to be relatively brief to cover what you think is important to cover, so we know that, but we don't need to have four people making the same point. So if you'll make it relatively brief, that'd be great. But take as much time as you need to make your case.
Thank you.
Any order? Start by introducing yourself.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I am Jenny Hawthorne Mays, Program Director for Daisy Chain Mothering. And I'm Jacqueline Mahoney.
You introduce yourself as you start your testimony.
Okay. And I can just start right away and say whatever I please. Okay.
Whatever you please.
Well, the record.
Yeah. Thank you for a hearing on this bill today. We're very excited. I'm here as an advocate for mothers and babies and also for IBCLCs practicing in the state of Oregon. We would like to see this bill passed as a way to provide excellent care to ensure equitable access to excellent care across the state of Oregon. We believe licensure for IBCs will help is one very important step in that process. Licensure provides consumers, healthcare providers, insurance personnel, and employers with the ability to identify qualified lactation consultants and lactation providers. Licensure also provides a means of standardizing the practice and maintaining sound oversight of lactation professionals. Licensure will provide the opportunity for reimbursement within a healthcare system. It also helps to ensure timely access to skilled, competent, trauma-informed, and culturally relevant breastfeeding support for all mothers and babies in the state of Oregon. Licensure will provide reimbursement services that will positively impact the growth of the profession of lactation consulting and help to create adequate numbers of diverse IBCLCs needed to meet the current and future needs of the state of Oregon. I can keep talking unless anyone has a specific question for me, which I would appreciate.
I do have a specific question, but I was going to have a question, so after, let me ask you this. Is it the intention of this bill, in your mind, to prevent people from providing those services who are not licensed?
Part of the intention of the bill, sorry, Mr. Chair and representatives, that part of the intention of the bill is to ensure that anyone practicing within this scope is meets all qualifications for excellent care, and that providers who have not met those qualifications are not presenting themselves to the community under false pretenses or under lesser.
It's a title protection rather than a practice protection.
I think it's both title and practice.
Yeah. So if somebody could do what you do and call themselves a mother's aide or something, you would still not let them do that?
Well, providers operating within their scope of practice should call themselves whatever that title is. So if I'm, for example, if I'm operating as a, if I'm telling folks I'm a lactation consultant under this act, I would have to be a licensed IBCLC in order to call myself a lactation consultant and provide services within that scope. Does that answer the question?
Almost. We're getting close. Could the person providing those services you just talked about but not call themselves under this title still do that job, or would they be, it would be an illegal practice?
There is, if it's incident to their practice, if it's included in something that they're already doing under a separate license, no. So,
what if it's not, though?
Okay, so
let me frame the question in a way. We have two different things. One is a practice, one is a title protection. Nobody can call themselves an X. The other is nobody can do that X unless they're licensed. And that was a big problem with the direct entry midwives, for example, a related field, because they wanted to have licensing for direct entry midwives, but they didn't want to force direct entry midwives to be licensed. And I was just trying to figure out which of those things we're talking about here.
In order to, I think it's both. So if you want to call yourself a lactation consultant and practice within that scope, you would be required to be licensed.
Can you put those two things in the same sentence? So.
Right. So that's my understanding of how the
but
bill
if
is written.
If you want to do those things, but you don't want to call yourself a lactation consultant, will it be legal to do that?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay. That's what I was saying. Representative Bueller.
Follow up, if I may, to your line of question, Chair. So I'm very supportive of what you're trying to accomplish, but I'm concerned you might have the opposite effect you're intending if that's the case, because you will have a, probably at least for initially, a lot fewer people able to provide the service, a lot less access to this education for mothers until you get a whole bunch of people trained and certified to be able to deliver this service.
Okay, so Mr. Chair and Representative Bueller, to answer that question, that has been brought up as a concern from other interested parties, and we appreciate that as a concern because the intent of the bill is to increase equitable access across the state to these types of providers. So for now, let's just focus on IBCLCs or lactation consultants as one provider type. Currently, I think the estimate is that there's about 400 who hold that certification. In order to apply for this licensure, you present evidence of the certification that's already being held by 400 members of the state of Oregon, and then you also present evidence of cultural diversity training and trauma-informed care, and then you're granted the license. So essentially everyone who, all the existing providers that are here in Oregon, about 400, qualify for the licensure. So why this would help increase more people coming into the field is because by holding licensure, this allows the provider to be able to bill insurance directly, and it becomes a sustainable business. So you would see more people going into private practice, small business owners providing this service, and women or people who want to come forward and join the field would also see it as more lucrative. They would be able to possibly support themselves with this sort of certification. So it actually
lessen,
thank you, the pool of qualified people. It would only seek to enhance the pool of qualified people who would continue to come into the profession every year.
I think we need to move on. We've got a bunch of witnesses to testify. Okay. Aren't you sorry you asked your question?
No, I like answering questions, so I'm not sorry.
Move next, please.
Sure. My name's Jacqueline Mahoney, and I'm co-founder and executive director of Daisy Chain Mothering in Eugene, Oregon. And we're really excited that you all are here and listening to this bill, and we've done a lot of work this year to reach out, and I've been so inspired by the support from the representative and from all of you and from all the other people in Oregon that are excited about this bill as well. And one of the things I wanted to point out is the American Academy of Pediatrics said that this supporting breastfeeding is a public health issue, and it's nice to see how it plays out in, you know, this room right now. What we're in essence responding to is the Surgeon General's call to action to support breastfeeding in 2011 because of all the benefits of breastfeeding. And our nonprofit provides services to International Board Certified Lactation Consultant at no cost. And what we see is in the state of Oregon, 90% of mothers start out breastfeeding, and that's one of the highest, or the highest in the nation. And the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends 6 months exclusive breastfeeding. And in Oregon, we also have one of the highest rates, which is we get 30%. And what we would like to see is 90%, and not we, but that's what the Surgeon General would like to see. And at our nonprofit, where these services, we don't bill for these services, we don't charge for these services, and families have equitable access and ongoing support, we have an 80% success rate at 6 months. And we ask our clients if they would hire an IBCLC if the services were not free, if they were not available at Daisy Chain, and only 15% said that they would. So we're really catching these people who otherwise would not have access to the support. We also ask them what their insurance companies are, and across the board we get all kinds of insurance companies. We serve families that have no income and families who have six-figure income, and 47% of in the last year were referred by the medical community. So we are seeing that the IBCLC services that we provide are in addition to the breastfeeding support that they're getting from their doctors and nurses and midwives, who are able to bill for this these services already. And what we believe is, when we open up that door and let these other groups that are not able to bill right now bill and have families have access to the service, we'll see that number go up across the state of Oregon of the families who are able to reach the 6 months exclusive breastfeeding goal. And I just wanted to comment on that question if I could as well, just real quick, is that when we first started this bill, we wanted to be inclusive of all breastfeeding support providers. So we wanted more than just the IBCLC, and because we believe that everyone has a place at the table, and, you know, peer support's important, family support's important, lactation educators, postpartum doulas, there's a range of support that is important and valuable. But what we found in these conversations, that it is best to, at this point, focus on the IBCLC, so that the unintended consequence of a peer support or a friend or a neighbor or someone at this different level is not going to, they're not going to feel like they can't be providing support, and that families will still have access to these other layers as well.
The bill 2503.
Correct, yes. And what we want to see is, this IBCLC is an international credential, and it's the highest training you can get in breastfeeding support. And so what we want to see is families to have access to that more readily, rather than waiting 2 weeks, as they sometimes have to do where we live, to get an appointment at their doctor's office with the IBCLC or at the outpatient with the hospital. We're taking those referrals.
Thank you.
So, yes.
Yes, please.
Hello, Mr. Chairman and committee. Thank you. My name is Sarah Longwell. I am an international board certified lactation consultant in private practice, and I'm also the lactation program coordinator at Birthing Way College in Portland. We are an academic program that provides a direct entry path into the lactation profession. So, in other words, our students can become lactation consultants without first becoming nurses or other healthcare providers. And our program is LARC approved and KHEB accredited. So I'm here today. Some of my points have already been covered by Jenny and Jacqueline, so I'll go ahead and skip forward. I do support the idea of licensure for lactation consultants, and I have some concerns about the bill before you right now, and I just want to share three little points with you. So my first concern is that this bill does not provide for a board composed of a majority of lactation consultants. HLO does not have expertise in providing care, as evidenced by the numerous boards under their administration, but this bill gives HLO total discretion in overseeing lactation licensees. At a minimum, I recommend a board be established to set standards to determine continuing education topics, to oversee complaints for unprofessional conduct or negligence, and in general to provide input and advice to HLO as it administers the statute. Such a board should have IBCLCs as the majority members, along with public members and related professionals such as midwives, nurses, physicians. My next point is that I am concerned, like some of you, that this bill could create a scarcity of access to IBCLC care in Oregon. I think the goal is to secure insurance coverage for and expand access to lactation services, but I'm worried about whether this bill accomplishes that. The licensure does not guarantee reimbursement or insurance coverage, and insurance providers can and do establish a variety of hurdles for us to overcome when seeking reimbursement and coverage for our services, especially for private practice IBCLCs who are doing home care or like small clinic care. Finally, I'm concerned that access to lactation consultation services will be reduced due to the additional potentially high licensing fees that could result from this statute. I heard Representative Nathanson say 150 to 200, which is much better than what I had been hearing, which was closer to 500 per year or more has been suggested. And that's really assuming that all of the 400 current IBCLCs in Oregon become licensed and pay their fees. So, I just wonder if, like, some amendments and changes need to be made. I do think that the bill should include a cap on licensing fees so that it will not be so high as to limit especially self-employed or private practice IBCLCs from seeking that licensure.
The bill is not able to do that because it needs to be self-supporting, so you need to figure out how many licenses and how much it costs to do it and the fees. But they are approved by the Ways and Means Committees here before they do it to make sure that they're reasonable.
So anyway, I suggest that this is a really important topic and maybe not ready to move forward.
Thank you very much.
I have a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you talked about 400 lactation consultants. Is there a different number of lactation educators that are accredited through the Lactation Education and Accreditation and Approval Review? Is that in addition to the 400, or some of those 400 are also education educators?
There isn't really a way for us to pull up that number, but there is more lactation educators in addition to that 400.
Okay, so the number is going to be bigger than 400.
Correct,
overall.
Yes.
And follow-up? Have you done any kind of survey to see how many of those 400 plus would want to be licensed?
We have not in the state of Oregon, but it is a national trend, and the official position of the USLCA, which is the lactation.
And one last question?
Yep.
So you mentioned Georgia and Rhode Island. I'm assuming they have a licensing program. Are there other states as well? Those are the first two.
The first two, and there's other states working on it. Florida, New Mexico,
Massachusetts.
Georgia.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Would you call the next panel, please?
We have Paul Cosgrove on both of them, and then Jen Baker is signed up for 2504.
All right. And one more?
Well, then we'll go to the agency people.
Okay.
And there's two of them.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Cosgrove representing Healthy Children Project. Healthy Children Project is a nonprofit located in outside Boston. It is a national certified agency, amongst many other projects it does, for certified lactation counselors, advanced certified lactation counselors, and advanced nurse certified lactation counselors. Our concerns with the bill are technical in nature, but I think relatively important. We completely agree with the proponents of the bill that lactation services are important for healthy mothers and children. No disagreement at all on that. And in fact, one of the things I filed on OLIS is the CDC report card for 2016 for the state of Oregon and all other states. We should be proud that although we're not perfect, we are amongst the highest states in terms of lactation breastfeeding amongst mothers in the country. We're either at the top or second to the top in all of the last recent surveys. So we're doing something right, which is good, and we could do better. No disagreement there as well. So we agree with the goals, but we just don't believe this bill is the right way to further those goals. The CDC report also points out that part of our success and part of the measurement of our success is how many both IBCLCs, the folks who you just heard from, and CLCs, my clients, certificated providers, are available in the state. Both are recognized as having a valuable role to play. They both do the same kinds of services.
Well, please differentiate the two again.
That's part of the problem, I think.
Even the words.
International Board, Certified Lactation Consultants versus Certified Lactation Counselors.
Oh boy.
And the reason that the bill causes us problems is it makes differentiations between the two groups.
Right.
CDC does not make between the two groups. U.S. Breastfeeding Council does not make differentiation between the two groups. The ACA does not make differentiation between the two groups. The ACA does not require either of the two groups to be licensed in order to be reimbursed, and it does require all health insurers to reimburse. It even requires health insurers who don't have sufficient resources in their panels to allow out-of-network reimbursement until such time as they do have sufficient resources in their panels. The training is a little bit different, but ours is based on the World Health Organization. IBCLC is differently based. They're both good. They're both recognized as being good. But this bill talks about licensing of one and not the other. We, too, have CLCs, our licensees, who are registered nurses. And there's another issue, I think, for both certification organizations. What happens if you're certifying, and we all are, physicians or nurses or nurse practitioners, should they have to get a second license? We don't believe so. The issue, I think, really is reimbursement. I think you've heard that from, we agree with Representative Nathanson, that's an important issue. I just learned that there may be issues within our own Oregon Health Plan on reimbursement, which I think we need to address if they exist. There may be reimbursement issues in particular CCOs. As we had a meeting with the proponents last week, on Friday morning, it appeared that at least their local CCO may not be reimbursing for these, or at least not reimbursing out of network, even though they don't have sufficient resources in network. So I think there are lots of issues we could talk about in terms of reimbursement, but we don't believe that licensing is the issue. It will increase the cost. We have CLCs, our licensees, in tiny little towns in Oregon. I had to just look up where, this is embarrassing, where Westlake, Oregon is. But we have a CLC in Hines, Oregon, and Lakeview, Oregon, and John Day, Oregon, and Westlake, Oregon. These are people who spent a good considerable amount of time getting our licensure and are practicing in their communities, helping mothers and making healthier mothers and healthier babies. A licensing requirement in the state of Oregon, and as you've heard, we would be only one of three, we think is not necessarily going to help the problem. It might hurt the problem in terms of cost and difficulty. We ought to address the problem of reimbursement. So that we're willing and able to step up and work with others to try to address the issue of reimbursement, both within the health plan and with commercial insurance, and we think that's where the best answer is. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer questions.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, Jen Baker on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. ONA absolutely supports the mission of this bill, which is to increase access to breastfeeding support for mom and babies. In fact, registered nurses do the vast majority of initial breastfeeding support for new mothers and babies. And many of our members who work in child and maternal health choose to go on to receive additional certification for further professional development, education, and training, either CLCs or IBCLCSs. And our concern is that by not excluding OSBN licensees from a requirement to have an additional license for their certification, that it would create a disincentive for these nurses to go on and further their professional development and be able, so by default, lessen the pool of providers with the certification who are able to provide support with mothers who are struggling the most. Additionally, we have an across-the-board position of ensuring that all nurse practice regulation reside with the Oregon State Board of Nursing so that nurses don't have to maintain licensure for individual acts that are within their practice already regulated by the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
Safe to assume you'd have no problem if nurses were excluded from the...
Love to see nurses excluded.
I think that was something she was talking about.
Can I go
here? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just wondering if nurses have the certification, if they're lactation consultants from the International Board, or whether they have the lactation education accreditation, or do they get their training through a nursing program? How do they... What is their training and what is their accreditation?
So, Chair Greenlich, Representative Kenny Geyer, initial breastfeeding support is part of the RN program, and then many nurses who specialize in child and maternal health would then go on to get one of these certifications.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Speak up.
Thank you, Chair Greenland. I had the opportunity to attend the stakeholders meeting that was held on last Friday, and we discussed the important goals of establishing more people to advance the cause of good mother-baby connection with lactation. I've been a nurse for 35 years. My whole career started off in labor delivery, postpartum, and then home visiting with mothers. I'm not an IBCLC. I did basic, you know, education regarding breastfeeding, and we depend a lot on those people that have that IBCLC training for those people that need that. I'm very, very supportive of getting as many mothers that need, you know, those kinds of lactation supports to them. But we need to work on some, I think, amendments to this, because I have a concern about nurses needing a separate license. I did the training that is necessary to do basic lactation consulting, and I would have grave concern that someone would make me do that all over again, that there's a mound of people who have that expertise in encouraging them to do the training if they want, but not making them do a separate license. That's very redundant in my opinion. So I'm hoping we can continue to work in the stakeholder meeting and iron out these things so we can achieve the goals that we're all hoping to achieve.
Perhaps you could take the lead for the committee and coordinating with the...
Sure.
A volunteer.
No good deed goes unpunished in this
Well, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so.
Administrator?
Sylvie Donaldson from the Health Licensing Office and Silky Ackerson from the Oregon Midwifery Council.
And it was pretty avant-garde to be going back to breastfeeding in 1974. She breastfed both of us, but it was, you know.
All right, you got to do the mop-up job.
Chair Greenland, and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sylvie Donaldson. I'm the Health Licensing Office Director. I'm here to talk about both bills. They're very similar to each other, 2503 and 2504. 2503 creates two license types, lactation consultants and lactation educators. And 2504 adds on lactation peer support providers. And the way that bills are currently written, these are both practice acts. So in order to do the field, you must have the license. Both the bills have the licenses where it would be administered as a program underneath of our umbrella. We do have 14 boards and programs. The most recent program is music therapy, so it would be very similar to that. The bill's written very similar to that. It does create some exceptions, and it has great qualifications. There's not a lot of rules that would need to be created. Ours would then create the rules that goes along with both statutes. It fits within how the office currently works. It administers its programs underneath of it. Thanks for the opportunity to testify, and if you guys have any questions.
Would it be a lot more complicated to create a board? There was some testimony out.
Chair Greenlake, I don't think it's more complicated. It's more of how you want it to go. If there's not a lot of work for the board to have to decide, then it's kind of more expensive to have a board and for them to meet and to, if they need to do practice standards or if they need to create qualifications, that's different. Kind of depends on how clear it is in the statute.
Other questions? Thank you.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Silke Akerson, and I'm the director of the Oregon Midwifery Council. We represent direct entry midwives in Oregon, as well as birthing and new families. And midwives in general couldn't praise lactation consultants more. They're such a huge benefit for mothers and new families in Oregon, and I think their services create enormous cost savings for health systems in Oregon, because we know there are all these long-term health benefits of breastfeeding. We would love to be able to support a bill that increased access to lactation consultants that had broad stakeholder support from lactation consultants and from consumers. I don't think that this bill currently has broad stakeholder support. When I learned of the bill in my review of the bills for 2017, I called each of the lactation consultants that I currently work with, both in my own practice and then in the Midwifery Council, and none of them knew about the bill, and a number of them had concerns about the bill. So my main input is that I think there needs to be broad outreach to stakeholders, not just lactation consultants themselves, but lactation peer educators and peer support providers, and then the families that are served by these, because I have some of the similar concerns about whether or not this will increase or decrease access. But the main thing that I just wanted to say absolutely clearly is that while we could very much support a bill that's for the licensure of lactation consultants, we would oppose any bill that licensed lactation educators or lactation peer support providers, because those are enormously gray areas, and there are very long-standing peer support groups like La Leche League that have been around for decades providing this peer-to-peer support and education. There are also breastfeeding classes, and I think it would be excessive regulation for there to be a license act involving those groups. There are not, you know, there's not a safety issue that we're trying to address. There's not a reason to do it, and I fear that it would decrease access to these peer support groups and classes that are of enormous benefit to many people. And then the last thing I want to add is that there are a number of professions that would be affected by the bill, not just nurses. So there are lactation consultants of both types of certification who are their education is kind of standalone in those fields, but there are nurses who are lactation consultants, there are midwives who are lactation consultants, there are physicians and naturopathic physicians who are lactation consultants. So there's quite a few healthcare provider types that this bill would potentially affect. And I'm happy to answer any questions about any of those pieces.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman. If I could just make a comment.
Yes.
I appreciated you mentioning La Leche League, and I was just looking it up. They've been in existence for 60 years. Mm-hmm. Back in 74, my wife was among the avant-garde going to their meetings.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2503. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2504. And move to a public hearing, to open a public hearing on House Bill 2140. Madam Administrator, what do we got?
2140?
I'm sorry,
2340. Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2340 comes to before the committee at the request of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It authorizes DCBS to permit an insurer that has discontinued offering a health benefit plan in a service area to reduce the mandatory five-year ban. It reorganizes and updates. I'm just going to stop there. We have
that's fine.
Laura Calley and Jeanette Taylor.
The DCBS is not quite ready to make final comments on this bill, but we've asked them to give a sort of review of where things are going at DCBS. Any comments you'd like to make on this bill would be great, too.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Greenlake, Vice Chair Hayden, Vice Chair Nose, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laura Callie Robison. I'm the administrator for the DCBS Division of Financial Regulation. I also have with me Jeanette Taylor, who's a senior policy analyst with the division, and so she'll be here to help me in answering any questions. I think we're fairly far along with this bill, and so I'm going to, if that would be okay, I'll just run through the key points.
I must be thinking of the bill from Wednesday. In fact, I am.
Yeah, we have a few of them around.
Try and be ahead at all times. Not 2 days ahead, usually. Go ahead, let's talk about this bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be pretty brief. Witness. This bill, House Bill 2340, addresses two key issues. The first is a series of technical changes that are really intended to clarify which statutes in the insurance code apply to which types of entities. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. And then the second piece deals with an existing five-year ban that applies to health insurers if they choose to leave a market. And the bill would actually give the department some discretion in shortening that ban. So first I'll talk about the technical pieces of the bill. There are a few different types of legal entities that provide health benefit plans, what we think of as major medical insurance policies. So health insurers, health care service contractors, or HCSCs, and multiple employer welfare arrangements. We call them MEWAs. And so these are three different types of entities all defined in the law that they all provide health insurance in the state. There are some structural differences between the entities, but a lot of the elements of the insurance code apply to all three types of entities. And if you want to spend some good quality time with the insurance code, you could probably trace through and find which of them apply to which type of entity, but it can be somewhat circular and not very straightforward. And as you know, we've been going through, you know, for example, the bill we'll talk about on Wednesday, talking through some of the reconnects to federal law, it's been a bit of a challenge to kind of run through what applies to which entity. So this bill makes that more straightforward and really tries to clarify without having to jump through a bunch of different circular references which requirements apply to which type of entity. In some cases, we also remove some references that just didn't really make sense but had kind of popped up over the years. So we do have a couple of things that we've noticed after we reviewed the bill draft that may require an amendment to just make sure that the technical fixes are just right. So we'll work with you to see if you'd be willing to consider that. The second piece deals with the five-year ban. It's currently in Oregon law. If a health insurer decides to discontinue offering health benefit plans in a particular market, they can't return to that market for 5 years. And this ban was put in place to maintain stability in our markets, to make sure that we are guarding against insurers leaving at a particular time and then reentering when, you know, conditions were, you know, more favorable to the insurer, really to kind of create some consistency in the number of options available to consumers and really to make sure that there was a level playing field. And so that was the reason for having the five-year ban. And we believe that it's really important for there to be incentives for carriers to stay in markets and also to make sure that we're not discouraging kind of rash decisions to leave markets. But one of the things that we've also considered over the years as we've kind of seen some things ebb and flow with our market is that there may be reasons that an insurer needs to leave a market that aren't grounded in wanting to game the system. So, for example, an insurer might be facing financial issues and choose to leave a market so that it can shore up other parts of its business and better protect the members on its books. Mr. Chair, it does. It certainly can happen, and it happens in other states as well. And the flip side of this is there might be circumstances over a period of time where you see players leave a market and then you end up with fewer competitors than you really intended to. But the five-year ban is actually, takes away a tool from us as a regulator and is, really trying to look out for the public in terms of making sure that there are enough options for people. So it's a firm ban, and we don't have any discretion to be able to look at current market conditions and say we might need to think about allowing carriers to come back sooner. So the bill, House Bill 2340, would give the department the ability to review current market conditions, assess the reason that the carrier initially left the market, and consider other factors to figure out if it's appropriate to have a shorter ban. We would engage in public rulemaking to really set forth the criteria and the process that we would use for considering whether to shorten that ban. It's important that we maintain, really some stability and make sure that this is still, there's still a disincentive to just leave the market on a whim, and that it's not something that we're kind of dealing with on a year-to-year basis, but that this is a tool that we have in our toolbox to be able to maintain a good competitive market and make sure that consumers, individuals, and groups have options to find other coverage. So with that, I am happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Are you going to testify?
Chair
Are
Greenlee?
You just riding shotgun?
I'm riding shotgun and okay. Happy to do so.
Are there
you.
Questions of the witness? I'm surprised nobody signed up in opposition or to comment on it, which is interesting. I had heard there was a little uneasiness about the notion that the fear that it would increase the movement in the market, but the same people I talked to in that regard said they felt pretty comfortable that if you were keeping control of that, that it might not be an issue. And you addressed that in your testimony.
Chair Green, like we had heard the same concern, and with this bill, we've been working on this for a number of months with stakeholders, and we had heard that concern raised, and we shared that concern too about making sure that we're balancing flexibility to, you know, to give us that tool to solve a particular type of problem while not completely eroding the 5-year ban and kind of the deterrent effect that it has. So I mean, we do understand and agree with that concern of making sure we strike the balance, and I think that going through rulemaking will help us be able to talk through with stakeholders about what really are kind of the appropriate things for us to consider in making that decision and make sure that it's equitable and transparent.
Well, seeing no opposition, we'll set up a work session for the bill. You have some technical amendments coming?
Chair Green, like, yes, we have some minor technical amendments, and so we can work with you and
you coordinate
staff.
That with Sandy, and we'll...
We'd be happy to.
We'll get the amendments going. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm glad we finally got the bill straight. That's very handy. I'll close the work session on House Bill, public hearing on House Bill 2340, and open a public hearing on 2465. Madam Administrator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2465 comes to us at the request of Representative Holvey and Kennemer. It permits a professional corporation organized to practice medicine under current law of ORS 58375 to add to and include a licensed nurse practitioner as a permissible holder of the required majority of each class of shares that are entitled to vote as a required majority of directors and as all officers except the secretary or treasurer. We have...
Representative Kennemer, are you going to introduce this?
I think I'll defer, please, to the Nurses Association.
Okay, great.
Jen Baker and Tom Doyle. Courtney, did you? I don't know. Okay.
Chair Green, like members of the committee, Jen Baker on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association and Nurse Practitioners of Oregon, here in support of House Bill 2465. This bill essentially would, what we hope this would do is clean up statute to allow nurse practitioners to be majority shareholders in clinics where they either employ or are in partnership with a physician, or more commonly the problem.
By majorities. Cheryl, as you mean to be among the minority, not entirely the minority, or the majority?
Then currently, as the statute is written, a nurse practitioner cannot hold the majority shares of a clinic if practicing in a corporation with a physician. And the larger problem that's really surfaced is for nurse practitioners who are working with a physician and want to buy out the physician as he or she may be retiring. If the corporation is structured this way, they face additional challenges. So this is in line with a lot of the issues that come before your committee that we bring to help remove arbitrary barriers to nurse practitioner practice and increase access to quality patient care throughout the state. And I have with me today Tom Doyle, who I think can get into some of the more complex pieces of the statute.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick. I'm Tom Doyle, a partner at Bennett Hartman. I'm also legal counsel for the Nurses Association. It's a pleasure to be here today. I provide written testimony, but essentially there's two points that I would highlight. Essentially, under the current statute, a nurse practitioner is prohibited from being a majority owner. By the majority, that means 50% or more, oddly enough. So essentially, a nurse practitioner could not be in a co-ownership partnership with a physician because the physician would have to have 51%. This bill essentially evens the playing field. and allows a nurse practitioner to be a majority owner in a professional corporation. One of the important points is that it's not a question of practice. This does not approach it from a practice perspective. In other words, it does not expand a nurse practitioner's scope of practice. The second point is that that's firmly in the hands of the licensing bodies, both in terms of the medical board and in terms of the nursing board, in terms of scope of practice. The bill, so in other words, a nurse practitioner might be an owner in a professional corporation that's formed to provide or practice medicine, but the nurse practitioner is not practicing medicine, and nothing about this bill changes that. Rather, it's simply an ownership question. Can they be an owner in that professional corporation? The second issue is that what this bill does is vests those boards with the final decision-making authority about what those what the composition and ownership is. In other words, the medical board could still be allow and require only majority ownership by physicians if they so choose. So this bill allows the discretion to those boards to be able to look at those practice questions and in terms of the ownership. But at this point, the law would prevent them from doing so. So essentially, this bill gives those boards the ability to allow that co-ownership or that ownership by a nurse practitioner. Those are the two points that I had. I'm available to answer any questions that you have, sir.
Other questions?
Alonzo Leon.
Representative Alonzo Leon, please.
Yes, thank you for that presentation. You mentioned there are some challenges or barriers for nurse practitioners to have ownership, complete ownership. What are some of those barriers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Alonzo Leon, essentially, I personally represented individual nurses, nurse practitioners, and those individual nurse practitioners who want to be entrepreneurial and want to own a business, want to buy, let's say, a professional corporation that practices medicine, would be unable to do so under the current law. In other words, that professional corporation, as it currently exists, professional corporations, along with a lot of other business forms, are in some use depending on the entity. But a current existing professional corporation could not be purchased in whole or even a 50-50 partnership with a physician. So those are the type of impediments that currently exist.
Could a nurse own a professional corporation to do nurse practitionering?
Yes, they can. So a nurse practitioner can form a professional corporation that establishes for nurse practitioning, if you will, Mr. Chair. But this doesn't really address that. This bill addresses the ownership of a professional corporation in which there's the practice of medicine, and it allows the co-ownership or the majority ownership by the nurse practitioner to acquire those clinics that are currently operating.
Dave Kenimer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think... we've been working, and this is more a comment than a question. I think for a long time we've been working on the issue of nurse practitioners and equity within medical practice or within the practice of treatment of patients within different levels of competence. And historically we have what I would see as an obsolete barrier to ownership. These are qualified, bona fide, licensed medical providers, and it seems to me that it's entirely appropriate that they have a right to participate in the marketplace just as others. And so for me, it's an equity. I think parity is the thing, and competence is the basis. And I guess it has the added feature, it increases access to care. So... That's my modest view.
Thank you. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. I'm very supportive of the concept, too, and I'm just wondering if there are any other professions like physician assistants or chiropractors or anyone else that might be left out of this.
Representative Kanagaya, Mr. Chair, my understanding, certainly they're not included with this bill. I think that the notion of an independent provider is where this bill at this point draws the law in terms of nurse practitioners and physicians, and so that's why it's written as it is now. So certainly those other professions are not included in this bill, but there might be some logical reason for that as well.
Okay, thank you. Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Thank you for your testimony. One of the reasons behind the boards and their processes and the licensing is that when there's a problem and a patient has a concern, they go to the board, they file a complaint, and that may turn into legal matter. It may not. It may be resolved. But it gives a definite person in charge. So they can say, okay, you know, so we don't get this thing going on during lawsuits. So if you have a nurse practitioner under this scenario, it appears that they could hire a physician, which traditionally that physician has been, you know, that's where the buck stops, right? Even though it may include other lawsuits. Would this change that? Would the buck stop now at the nurse practitioner or the physician?
Representative Hayden, Mr. Chair, and part of my alter ego is that my partners represent personal injury clients on occasion, so I can kind of think about that from that perspective as well. This would not change anything in terms of the liability of the provider. So the person who is providing the care, and let's say there's a negligence action there, that provider, whether it's a nurse practitioner or a physician, would still be liable. The business in those situations might also be liable, and the ownership of that business might be at issue in terms of the professional corporation. So this doesn't change anything in terms of the individual liability. The business, if it's owned 49% or 50%, still that ownership by that nurse practitioner is still at issue if there were a lawsuit against the business also. So it doesn't change anything except for that. Now the nurse practitioner could potentially be a little more liable if they own more of that business. I hope that answers your question.
Okay.
Sir.
Well, I guess we'll hear the other perspective in a little bit. Thank you.
And Bueller, we might hear it right now.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So can a physician similarly own shares in a professional corporation that performs nurse practitioner services?
Representative Bueller, Mr. Chair, under this bill, if a physician were to own, let's say, a majority of the shares of a professional corporation that was formed for providing nursing services only, that would be allowed under this bill. That would be available.
And just to be clarified, because what Representative Kimmerer expressed, this affects the business relationship, not the delivery of care, right? So it's not going to expand the access to nurse practitioner services.
Well, if I may, Representative Bueller, Mr. Chair, essentially it's a question of the ability of individuals to purchase businesses and essentially to be ownership in that. So in the sense that there is a greater pool of individuals that may be able to buy a clinic, let's say, that's going under, and there is a physician that does not want to have that clinic going any further, that this opens the pool under which an individual who is a nurse practitioner would be able to purchase that professional corporation. In that sense, it continues or increases the accessor.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, in fact, following on this point, I think it increases that access because at this point, if a physician is, for whatever reasons, getting out of that corporation, their only option is to sell that to a physician. This offers another option. So,
just a point of clarification, you could sell to a lot of entities other than physicians. I mean, you
thank
could sell
you. That
to
is,
hospital systems or...
Okay, yes, thank you. That is a... thank you. That's a good correction. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you both very much.
Adds to the options.
Thank you.
We have one more witness. Please call.
Cordy Dresser of the Oregon Medical Association.
Good afternoon. Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association, and I apologize. My general counsel could not be here, so I'm going to pretend to be an attorney, which is
you don't
as
want
dangerous
to practice law without a license.
Dangerous as pretending to be a doctor, so bear with me. OMA is supportive of the concept of nurse practitioner ownerships. That's not our concern with this at all. We are like to figure out ways for different type of multidiscipline licensures to have ownership. However, the way that it's drafted now, it is it looks like a simple fix, but it doesn't. It causes more issues because it drops it right into the professional corporations organized to practice medicine. And in our state, the term practice medicine is defined as ORS 677. 677 is the Medical Practice Act, which is covers physicians, physician assistants, and DOs. So nurse practitioners aren't part of that Practice of Medicine Act, and so it opens up to a whole bunch of other issues. So as much as we want to make this fix, because we want to, if physicians want to sell to a nurse practitioner, that's great. And if we can expand access in some way, wonderful. This is the simple fix is not the answer. It opens up the door to other issues.
Do you have a problem that I hear you understanding your problem is which part of the law is housing?
The way that they put it in the Professional Corporations Act.
Is there somewhere you'd prefer to put it?
We're willing to sit down and figure that out. We have been going back and forth with the... This is an issue that was brought up a couple sessions ago. I think we're just still trying to figure out where it needs to go. But we're open to having those discussions.
And right now, the thing that they're trying to overturn is in the Medical Practice Act.
It refers to the practice of medicine.
It's about the business of medicine as well as the practice of medicine.
It goes back to the professional side. This piece, ORS 58, is the statute for professional corporations for professional services. Part of it is 58.375, which is refers to the practice of medicine. Practice of medicine is defined in that statute as ORS 677.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if we could call the attorney that's working with Oregon Nurses Association back to the stand. I want to ask him a quick question, sort of in reference to what Courtney brought up.
Could you please join us?
Mr. Doyle. See, it sounds right here, line 6. Corporation organized for the purpose of practicing medicine.
May I ask my question, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
All right. So, hi, Tom. Thank you for being here. I'm wondering if to sort of assuage Courtney's concern from the OMA, what if we were to reference the Nurse Practice Act in the same place? So then it's clear that's about the practice of nursing, because this really to me just sounds like a legal thing about who gets to own the business and control it, you know, and not a scope of practice thing.
I Representative Knowles, Chair Greenleaf, I think that would. I do think. I think it's not necessary.
Repeat your name again.
Oh, I apologize, Thomas Doyle, legal counsel of Nurses Association. I think that would allay those concerns. I don't think that it's absolutely necessary, because I do think that there is a difference between the practice of medicine or the practice of nursing and a professional corporation that's formed for those purposes. Corporations. I'm very thankful to be able to say this, don't actually practice medicine.
They're people. They're legal people.
They are not licensed. So essentially that there's this term that's in terms of the corporate practice of medicine that we all don't want in some sense, which is to say that we do not want MBAs making decisions about medical care. That essentially that the practice of medicine that that is referring to here is simply in the professional corporation, that that's what the professional corporation is formed to enable those who are employed by it or owners in order to do. It's not the same as being coming under the jurisdiction of the board, Board of Medicine, from my perspective. So that amendment would address that concern, although I don't think it's absolutely necessary in order to maintain the effects of the bill as it's written.
We could say, yeah. Oh. Yes.
All right. Courtney, if we had an amendment drafted to that effect, would that make, would that put OMA more at ease with the bill?
I think I asked that question of our attorney, and I think his comments were that there would still be some issues that we probably have to address, because there's other pieces of 58, the statute, that aren't in this bill that probably would need to look at some amending and some changes. So at this point, I couldn't give you a for sure answer. But again, we're willing to figure that out.
Could we just delete the whole thing about the practice of medicine requiring a 50% majority physician?
I would think that might cause a little bit of more of an uproar, Chairman, as there's probably a lot of entities that are already organized in this manner. I was thinking, Chair, to that your answer to that question is that there's probably a bunch of entities already organized in this manner. So I'm not quite sure if changing all of that right now, I'm not quite sure what those would do to those entities that already exist under this.
I was only talking about eliminating the phrase that says the majority needs to be owned by a physician. If you just eliminated that, then any flower could bloom. Do you think that might be a problem?
Well, I'd have to, Chair, get back to the general counsel on that one.
He's opening it up more.
There might be some comments over here.
We heard a yes from the corner.
Yes, there might be some comment. Okay.
Kenny Geyer,
please.
Well, thank you, and I'm glad you're still up there, because I'm still back to my idea about physician assistants. I'm thinking of a clinic that might have a physician, a number of nurse practitioners, a number of physician assistants, and why not let everyone have an equity share in it, you know, proportionate to who works there. That might be something they want. And you were saying it had to be independent providers, that's why you're including nurse practitioners and not physician assistants. So I'm still wondering why that needs to be, if it doesn't have to do with the practice, it only has to do with ownership. Just theoretically. And then the other question is, and if that is true, then do the nurse practitioners, and I haven't read through the whole bill, have to then register or be coded as independent providers? Because they can or cannot be, as nurse practitioners, independent providers, correct?
Representative Kenny Geyer, Mr. Chair. I think essentially your question about PAs being included in terms of that ownership, what I was trying to establish is that there's a line to be drawn there. And I think the line that is drawn in this bill is that nurse practitioners, there's been a movement towards establishing them on an equal footing in many respects in terms of physicians. In terms of whether that line, and that's a policy choice for you all, is in terms of where that line goes. I think that the possibility of extending it further raises further questions that have to be vetted in terms of those individuals. The effect of the law is there in some sense to allow for independent providers to be able to make decisions without having ownership by non-medical personnel. And so as you look at that PA question, you know, I think you have to look at that through that lens of, does that accomplish that policy goal? And how broad do you draw or where do you draw those lines? In terms of the independent, as being independent provider, I think that you can't approach this with a sledgehammer, you have to approach it with a scalpel to some degree. But at the same time, a nurse practitioner has been recognized as having the level of independence and the licensure. And again, what's very important here is that those are decisions that I don't know the answer to. The Board of Nursing and the Medical Board very well might, in terms of where they want to draw those lines. That's a provider-driven board expertise question rather than something for the lawyers. It is for you as well. But from my perspective, that it draw that where to draw that line is essentially a very important question that's left to the boards.
We're talking about a specific form of practice, right? This, I mean, of business. This is a professional corporation. The multiple providers could form a 501c3 clinic. There are other ways that you could organize a practice that's not using this very specific one, which is a favorite, but not the only way that one can organize.
Mr. Chair, that's correct, and that's what I was trying to hint at before, that there's a number of different business organizations that are out there. To some degree, I've been told by my business organization person in my office that the PC form has there's a history there, but it may not be the first choice for many new clinics that are forming. But that being said, current ones, and this is where we get into the purchase issue, that's why it's come to the forefront. The purchase of an existing PC for a nurse practitioner, creates a number of headaches that this bill is designed to address.
Well, let me ask if you would spend a little time together, the two of you or a couple of other representative, and see if we can get something through that makes everybody happy. Representative Hayden, last comment.
Yes, thank you, Chair Greenlee. Just very, very quickly, the boards that regulate health practices have some very limited ownership and some less limited, up to, you know, having to require 51%. Do you see this, if this move forward, it looks to me like it would kind of break that mold and have ownership of a entity that was providing different scope of practice than the owner? I don't know that we've seen that before, but you've got an owner with somebody hired to provide a different scope of practice. Do you see that as any adverse potential for the patient, for the client? Is there any concern about who is responsible liability-wise with this different concept?
Chair Greenlake and Vice Chair Heron, I think that's when we're talking about adding Representative Nose's concern amendment idea was just to add. I think that's where you start to get some of those concerns about liability protection. Who's responsible? Where, I think someone said earlier, where the buck stops. Who's responsible for what? The Oregon Medical Board, I think, historically doesn't get involved in corporation pieces unless you're practicing unlawfully or without a license. But they are listed in here as someone who could, and it's the same. I think the amendment adds board of nursing. That's the potential. That's, I think, the potential problem that we need to walk through and talk through is that there's a lot of pieces here that need to be looked at before we just simply throw them into the corporate practice of medicine. And historically, that's there for reasons, and I think the attorney.
The reason is
so you didn't have
trade.
Yeah, well, you didn't. Well, the historic purpose was to ensure that physicians could provide care without being directed by non-physicians. So,
the purpose of those acts, I beg to differ, was to keep people like Kaiser Permanente out of the state.
Oh, so I.
As a matter of. Back going all the way back to Elk City Co-op in Elk City, Oklahoma, where they learned how to do it. We're going to close this hearing.
We have a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just am curious. I have a question as it relates to if a nurse practitioner purchases a practice from a physician, who regulates then the scope of practice that happens when you're transitioning the patients? Because there's a much different. I mean, who then says, is it the medical board? Is it the nurse practitioner? Is it the nursing board that, because you're talking, one can, you know, the differences in scripting, just what, I mean, where do the patients fall in all of this in the scope of practice piece and who regulates what in this transaction?
Representative Hack and Mr. Chair, my experience has been that a nurse practitioner who is buying that business is going to hire a physician. So that's what happens most of the time. Different providers have a lot of different attributes and are able to provide a lot of different services. Most clinics are going to have a physician that's part of that practice. This is purely a question of ownership, and there is no need to transition patients. So the distinction between ownership and the licensee that's being providing the care, that you could have in that situation the exact same physician providing the care for the patients. They may no longer be an owner of it, they could be an employee of it, but they still are providing the direct care. So in those situations, and I've seen other clinics that hire a locums physician in the interim, or just simply hire physicians to do that. Again, this is just an ownership question, not a question of who's providing the care, which would have to be by
and a physician. If that owner was practicing as a nurse practitioner, her practice would be governed by the nursing board.
Right.
And the doctor in that practice would be by the medical board.
So can I just have a follow-up?
Sure.
So in the transition of the sale of the practice from one physician to the nurse practitioner, and then the nurse practitioner hiring a physician, in that transition, who's responsible in the midst of that transition of the patients? So is there something in this that says during the sale of the clinic, one physician leaves, another picks up? Who takes, does the responsibility fall on the nurse practitioner in the transition of that because they now are the majority owner of the corporation? Or does it fall on the guy that just left? Or does it fall on the guy that's just coming as far as the care of the patient? Because what if something happens in between and somebody dies, something happens, is it the guy that left or is it the guy that's there? Is it the nurse practitioner who now owns the majority share of the corporation? I'm just curious.
Everybody gets sued.
But I mean, in the midst of it, who's responsible for the patient?
Representative, let me put on the other hat that I wore, which is I defend licensees on occasion, including doctors and nurse practitioners. Though that's an essential question that goes to the licensee's responsibilities to the patient. That patient has to be handed off appropriately from the one provider to the other provider. There should be no gap and licensing boards monitor that very, very carefully.
Okay.
To make sure that there is a handoff. So the patient is always taken care of. Again, this is simply an ownership question, not that extremely important question in terms of the provider-patient relationship, which has to be handled extremely carefully.
Thank you.
Good question. Thank you. All right. Get something done here, huh? Good. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2465. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2395. Who is that masked man?
Not wearing a mask.
Welcome.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chair. For the record, my name is Rob Nose. I'm the state representative for House District 42, and House Bill 2395 is a committee bill, but it comes to us via one of my constituents, who unfortunately is not able to be here with us today. So she submitted, I'm told, testimony in OLIS, but I'm just going to kind of quickly give a high-level overview of what she's concerned with. Mary Ann Schwab is a retiree who used to work with Portland Public Schools, but she's very active in our community, and she frequently contacts my office to advocate on a lot of different issues. She cares for her husband, Irwin, who is currently not in the best of health. And Mary Ann spoke with me and my staff about this concept. I initially learned that Irwin has 9 different doctors and a pretty long laundry list of prescription medications that he takes in order to stay healthy. This bill is an attempt to help people like her husband, who are prescribed multiple medications. The bill would require the Oregon Medical Board and the State Board of Pharmacy to create some rules that would require prescribing physicians to list the purpose of the drug on the label. Now, Mary Ann's husband, Irwin, he is fortunate enough to have her to help him manage his prescriptions, but they fear there are many seniors out there who do not have that kind of support. and someone who's in poor health has to move to assisted living or maybe hire a caretaker, having some sort of vernacular information on the label for the medication would help them, you know, sort of protect them from inadvertently mixing up the medications that they're supposed to be taking. That's really what she's seeking. Something that says in plain English, what is this medicine supposed to do? What ailment is it supposed to be treating? I think it's a straightforward bill. I hope it's not too controversial. I don't think it costs any money, at least not the state any money. And hopefully it won't be overly difficult to implement. And I hope you'll join me in thinking about supporting this bill.
Can I carry forward the question that I was asking before? As you read the bill, it says it allows a it allows somebody to ask a physician to state the purpose on the prescription.
Okay.
Is there anything that blocks that now?
Probably not, Mr. Chair, but I think Marianne just thinks that this would be helpful. That extra layer of statute, I guess, would be helpful.
Yeah, this has to come out of the prescription because many drugs are used for
multiple things.
For multiple things. So the physician would have to say this is being used for colitis, not being used to strengthen the heart or something.
Yes.
I just made up a drug, but there are circumstances like that. It certainly right now is also possible to write the name of the drug on the label, which could help it. I sympathize with this because Harriet manages that, about nine drugs for me.
So, Mr. Chair, I suspect that they, you know, you look at some of these things, like I didn't know what Pepcid was or, you know, pick any other name that is made up. You know, it's hard to know, frankly, what it's supposed to do. Is it treating my diabetes? Is it treating my heart ailment? Is it treating my antacid? You know, is it making it so I can go to the bathroom? You know, I think it's just so she knows people that struggle with that, and she's trying to get just something that's in plain English on the label that reminds her or a loved one what they're doing.
Mr. Bueller, does this strike you? What is a prescriber?
My only concern is many drugs have more than one use, even for a single individual that would change based on circumstances. So you could write on there one time it could be used for X, but 6 months later it could be used for Y. So it introduced some confusion.
Sudafed, I understand, is to give you the energy to clean the garage.
There you go.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
And Alonzo.
So I'm sympathetic to this, having just gone through surgery not too long ago and having medicine for pain and for nausea, anti-nausea. I'm wondering if either of the physicians here have ever asked for something to be put on it. And in the bill, it seems to me, as the chair said, there's nothing to prevent a physician from doing it. It seems to me the only way that this would have any teeth would be to say, and the pharmacist must comply.
That would create problems.
You're not done yet, right? Are you?
No.
Do you want me to respond to the comment, or are you done?
No.
I'm done. I'm curious.
General Alonzo Leon, please.
Yes, thank you, Chair. So I found this bill interesting. I think it's a good idea. However, since we have a growing diverse population in languages, I even find value in having information in multiple languages because it's only in I'm assuming this is only in English because you said make it in plain English, which I think would help a lot of English speakers, but not necessarily our other language speakers. So just wanted to bring that out.
Sam Bueller, did you?
Hayden.
No, Mr. Hayden, I'm sorry.
Thank
That's
you, Chair.
Your name. Yeah. You guys look so much alike.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Vice Chair knows. On this particular bill, and you should know because you are also double hat with the nursing,
engage with a lot of seniors and disabled patients that are in a home-based center of some sort of assisted living, and their meds list are often multiple pages. But I have noticed over the years that there has been an aspect, and I'm assuming from the nursing aspect or care home, there's been an addition to that list that is required now that says what that medication is for. Right? So you got the medication, you got the dose, you got the time that you're supposed to give that, and then it says on those what it's for. Where is the regulation that, I mean, that's got to be coming from the physician in some manner of communication. Is the information out there already and we're just not capturing it?
Can I respond, Mr. Chair?
I see.
Representative Hayden, I suspect what's going on here is that my constituent is not in an assisted living situation. Her and her husband are just basically doing this together. You know, she's not in a nursing home. He's not in a nursing home yet, or they don't have someone that's coming by, and so it's just the two of them trying to figure out, as opposed to having someone who they either pay or is a professional or comes by once in a while, or, you know, where they're listing out all the medications and it's a little more regimented.
So this is talking about physically putting it on each label, not the description of what the drug does.
Yes. She wants it on the bottle.
On the bottle.
Cool. Monster.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. This sounds like a good idea. I draw on my experience again from doing home visits. I can't tell you how many times I've been to home visits and somebody drags out, you know, a basket or a bag full of medications and says, which one's my heart pill and which one's my hypertension pill? And it's like, gee, maybe it would be good to have that on the label. You know, it just seems like a practical thing to do. I do understand the principle that sometimes, you know, the usage of these drugs change over time, but something's better than blank, you know. And I do notice regional differences in certain providers and certain clinics. They just do that automatically. In other places, it's just blank all the time.
Well, they usually put the name on it nowadays. But
right, but I mean, not for, you know, use this for nausea or use this for whatever.
Is that a Bueller? Back to you.
Yeah, but there's nothing precluding
the real Bueller.
Thank you. There's nothing preventing providers from doing that now, right?
No.
And this is not requiring providers to do it, which I think that would be.
It's not requiring providers, and it's not requiring pharmacists to comply with your request.
So maybe that's where if the provider makes the request, we need to get the pharmacist to do it. Maybe that's where the sweet spot of this is. You know, patient has to request of her or his physician to do something, or a nurse practitioner, and then the pharmacist has to comply. I'm sure somebody from the pharmacy board is going to jump up right now. I can just
sneaking up behind you as we speak.
Well, I have
and add a $250,000 fiscal to it.
Are you? And the board of pharmacy, they are in the room. So do you want to invite them up?
No, I don't think we're at that point yet.
Okay. Rep. Kenner.
Would you like us to invite them up?
It's their opinion. My constituent.
Would the board of pharmacy like to have an opinion on this? Here we go.
Hi, good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and representatives of the committee. My name is Fiona Karbowitz, and I work as the board's consultant pharmacist. To your question, or the point about the indication being on the label, when it is prescribed, so when it's issued in the prescription or the order, the board of pharmacy would expect that the indication be written onto the label. If it's not present on the prescription of the order, we also kind of in the converse would expect that it wouldn't be guessed because of the potential for a drug being utilized for multiple things. So,
but would you expect a pharmacist under normal circumstances to call a physician and ask about its use if the patient wants it?
If there is any sort of question or concern, then yes, that couldn't be perhaps identified during the consultation that they are expected to have as well.
I can get this if you'd like.
Sure. No, we have. Okay.
Representative Kammerer?
Just a small point. Recently, I was in a medical appointment with an extended family member, and the physician was prescribing a medication that is not normally prescribed for that condition.
Off-label use. Yeah.
Well, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So I don't know what the liability is on that. If you know, it's kind of interesting how. Excuse me.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I suspect what happens is I believe my constituent probably did get the appropriate consultation, and then over time forgot.
Yeah.
Right. You know, they just didn't remember, or they have too many, you know, to keep track of, and they just lost track.
Oh, it's hard to keep track of. Mm-hmm. Kelly Geyer?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to remember from the pills that I just got a week ago. I think it said this for pain is needed, this for nausea. I think it said that on the label. So am I understanding you correctly that what you said is if a practitioner, a provider, prescribes and says for something, the pharmacist comply. And if it doesn't say, then you don't put anything. You do follow the directions of the doctors or prescriber right now.
Yes.
Well, it's usual when there's a conditional use. Take it if you're nauseated.
Right.
Don't take it.
Just kind
of. No, it's a drug I've been taking for 4 years. That's that little yellow one with the. That was for something or other. But it seems to work, so. Take it. For pain, it'll say, or for diarrhea. I mean, that way, that's a part of the ordinary instructions you would expect on a prescription.
So it seems like what we're asking for is already in place.
Somebody that hasn't filled a prescription in 50 years.
Yeah. It seems like what we have is already in place.
But can I clarify, Chair? So that when you prescribe, there's two broad categories of drugs, one that we call kind of PRN or as needed. Mm-hmm. So whenever you write an as needed prescription, you should write the indication for pain, for swelling, for shortness of breath. And then there's medications that you just take on a regular scheduled basis and usually don't write the indication for that.
It's quite possible, Mr. Chair, that my constituent is utilizing both. I don't know. She didn't tell me, you know, all that, but like it's probably a combination of those two scenarios going on.
You all think about this and help Representative Nose figure out where we're going to go with it. That would be very useful. And thank you for volunteering.
Thanks.
Thank you for taking care of your constituent, Representative Nose. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2395. And unless we have more in front of us, we are adjourned.
Early.
The comment that I made.